This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's Ollie.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/AmicusPlus to get access wherever you listen.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, December 14th, the Anyone But a Man edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia in the freezing cold DC studios. And in the freezing cold New York studios, we have June Thomas, a managing producer of Slate Podcasts. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah. It's actually toasty in the studio, but it's freezing in the streets.
Yeah, it's
the old
freezing
saying.
In the streets.
Toasty in the studio, freezing in the streets.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
So were you guys up late last night watching election results? Did it feel, did you have like the sort of PTSD reprisal of November? Were you like in that moment? My household was kind of in that moment. We were waiting like TikTok for the results of the Alabama election.
Yeah, definitely watching it. I was watching it via Twitter, and I saw a lot of people tweeting about how they felt triggered by the
needle,
the New York Times' election tracking needle, which kind of bounces around. But it just felt a little different than a year ago.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about it. I feel like that election is sort of the subtext of a lot of what we're talking about today. So let's get going. We are going to talk about first Democrats positioning themselves as the party of purity. What do we think of that? Is that a good political strategy? We will discuss. Second, we're going to talk about Slack. Does it even the playing field for women? And third, the New Yorker story Cat Person by Kristen Rupenian, which everyone is talking about. Everyone I know is talking about. It's the story that's captured our imaginations about the state of gender relations today, or maybe the state of dating. I'm not sure. And then in our Slate Plus segment, June, what are we talking about?
In our Slate Plus segment, we will be talking about sexy holiday sweaters. If you are not yet a member of Slate Plus and you want to hear that discussion and many other benefits, including ad-free podcasts, you should go to slate.com/xxplus.
All right, before we get going, listeners, I want to remind you that our next show is our call-in show. We've already gotten a lot of amazing questions, but we would love to hear more from you. Questions you have, is something in your life sexist, you're not sure, or really just any questions you have for us, we will play the question on the air in our next show and answer it. The number is 929-266-8195. That's 929-266-8195. So please give us a call, leave us a message. All right, so let's do our first topic, Democrats as the party of purity. We tape on Wednesday morning, so, you know, we are fresh from the excitement of the Tuesday night Alabama election, which with its unexpected result. I was reading tweets, getting texts from people, watching on TV, and basically, to our great surprise, I fully thought that Roy Moore would win, I have to say, but Doug Jones won instead. He's the Democrat. He's the first Democrat to win a Senate seat in Alabama in 25 years. And I think what this does, in a way, this to me, this Senate race should mean absolutely nothing because it's Roy Moore and he's in a category of one, you know?
Right.
It just seems like a return to sanity. But yet it seems to have set off, like, defined the boundary lines in politics in a very clear way. Like, it seems to have pushed the Democratic Party into the position that we can win if we ride this wave of woman anger. Before we get going on the party of purity, let's just analyze a little bit the election, the Alabama election, what happened and what it means for the future. So let me ask you guys, who pushed Roy Moore over the edge? Like, what lessons did the Democrats have to learn from the victory of Doug Jones?
Well, there was certainly a lot of black turnout, and I think black men went 93% for Doug Jones and black women were a remarkable 98%, or maybe not remarkable 98%. White people overwhelmingly voted for Roy Moore. And I think 62% of white women, I believe, somewhere in the low 60% of white women.
Yeah, Moore won white women by 29 points.
Right. Yeah. So. So certainly the engine for the Democrats in the Deep South is minorities.
Yeah.
The last time we talked about Alabama, we got an impassioned letter from a listener, which I certainly, you know, felt, where she was like, I, a white woman, am working my ass off in Alabama, as are lots of people I know, for Doug Jones. Like, don't tar us all with the same brush. And fair enough. But it is still appalling to me that Roy Moore was able to get, you know, that it was like 49.9 to 48.4. He got 48.4% of the vote in Alabama. Like, that to me is an embarrassment and a shame and all of that. But fortunately, those people like our listener and, you know, worked for Jones. People went out and voted for Jones. And so it's a little bit less of a shame and, you know, a little bit of sanity is reigning. But I'm not all that sanguine. It's crazy that a guy like that did so well.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of shows the power of tribalism, right? And that the demographic things that we expect people sort of to vote with, right? Like, you see, you're a woman, and Roy Moore is, you know, quite famous for being essentially anti-woman, in addition to his taste in teenage girls. He has said various things about women, you know, like maybe not being able to vote. He's not a friend of women. And yet so many of those women, that's not their primary identification when they go and vote. They are voting as, you know, probably at this point, their primal tribal identification is as a, you know, a Republican of a certain kind, but also, you know, an evangelical, all these other things are just a cultural affinity for what Roy Moore represents over what Doug Jones, who is pretty strongly pro-choice, what the difference between those people. And so I think it's just like we expect people to vote with what's most important to us when we vote, but that's not what they're going with.
And we can't forget that Doug Jones has civil rights history.
Yeah.
So there's sort of a there's you know, more than a tinge of race in this election. I mean, as you guys pointed out, you know, he had a vast percentage of the black vote and white people voted for Roy Moore. Can we break down the woman vote for a minute? I'm curious about white women. Like, I had this set. Roy Moore did shockingly well with white women. He just did worse with white women than other Alabama Republican candidates. That's what it seems to me the Democrats are focusing on this morning.
Right, yeah. He won by 29 points. Moore won white women by 29 points, but almost certainly, I don't have the numbers for how other Republican candidates have done with white women in Alabama in the past, but I presume they got much higher. They won by much higher.
Wow, though. I just need to rest my mind on the fact that he won white women by 29 points. That's kind of amazing. Whew. That's amazing.
Well, and black women are the engine of the Democratic Party, and I'm certainly not the first person to point this out, but it is, you know, they're severely underrepresented when you look at candidates, right? Like, I think there are a couple ways that Democrats are responding to the events of 2016 and, you know, one major strain within the party is like, oh, we need to sort of go back and capture the white working class man. We need to, like, run a certain kind of more centrist, populist, some combination of centrist populist white man, rather than sort of looking at who actually makes up the real base of the party, which is just an interesting thing.
But don't you feel like it's the tactics have shifted now, and they're sort of like they're tuning in to this idea that the feminist wave is what they want to ride to victory?
Well, I think that's the lesson of what's happening all around us now. Like, even in the last week, it seems like the Democrats decide, like, this, you know, Al Franken being asked to resign, think was actually a real watershed moment for the Democratic Party in figuring out what kind of territory they want to stake out in 2018.
And he resigned resistantly. I mean, that's why. That's where the Party of Purity idea came from. He resigned defiantly and resistantly, and he was basically beloved and thought to make a difference. So it was essentially Democrats and mostly Democratic women making a conscious choice that we are going to sacrifice someone who's an ally, who's like, you know, ideological ally, in order to stand for women, in a sense, and stand against sexual harassment. So it's like a very strong statement.
Well, and to have, higher ground, like to sort of look at Republicans who for years have framed themselves as, you know, the value voters party, right? Like, they, in some senses, have been a party that is in a really deep way about sexual purity or propriety for so many years. And then if you look at what's happening all around them in the party, it's not just the Roy Moore nomination. There are, notably Congressman Blake Fahrenholz has been accused of sexual harassment, and only one person in his party, you know, called on him to step down. Another congressman did have to step down, but it was because he went to the rather extreme place of asking some of the women who worked for him to be the surrogate for his wife, who was unable to.
Wait, why do you say that so hesitantly? That's like my favorite story of the year. That story is so insane about Trent Franks. Like, I constantly try and imagine, like, how he did it and, like, what logic went into his, because he's a Christian conservative brain, that he decided, like, he was going to justify his lust for these two women in his office by asking them to be surrogates and, like,
and
make
the
up this old whole
fashioned
crazy
way. That's the key part.
Yeah, like, family values story.
Yeah, we're calling it surrogates. That's not what it is.
Well, but he
also, like, $5 million? That is a hell of a lot of money.
I can't tell you what I would do for $5 million, but
but right.
Yeah, would you consider it? I'd be like, well, maybe. It's $5 million.
Would I consider it? I would do it in a heartbeat. Are you kidding me? For $5 million?
The old-fashioned way?
The old-fashioned way, whatever. God.
Oh, God.
I'll do the old-fashioned way every day for a year for $5 million. Come on. Wouldn't you?
No.
$5 million?
No.
Fucking hell. I would do anything for $5 million.
I'm not a high-end hooker, June.
Everybody's got a prize. Mine's $5 million.
The $5 million almost made me believe his story because, like you said, Noreen, high-end hookers. Like, there's lots of things you can do much cheaper in great secrecy.
Totally.
So why, like, earnestly proposition a young staffer in your office with this completely absurd, outlandish proposition? We are so digressing, but I can't get enough of that surrogacy story. It's my favorite of all. Like, of all the things you think, wow, there's just a lot of just horrible stuff that happens subterranean in this world. Like, that's one of the choice ones.
I mean, obviously, we can't look inside his soul and inside his brain. But to me, that story is more about, like, some of the people who are in Congress really shouldn't be in Congress. I mean, they should because people have voted for them repeatedly. But, like, that guy clearly has no place in Congress. His ideas are bonkers.
I feel so badly for his wife.
Yes,
that's a
absolutely.
Major reaction that
who is being used by him at every turn.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even at the final turn when he resigned, by the way, he said his wife was ill.
Exactly.
So he had to resign. Now, maybe his wife was ill. I don't know. But
yeah,
but
I mean,
anyway,
he said she'd been taken to hospital, which is something that would be really like, you're going to make that up? Like, surely even he wouldn't make that up.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's a total user.
But okay, that's a bridge too far for Republicans. But a lot of other stuff isn't. And so I think for, you know, people like Kirsten Gillibrand, who has, by the way, made sexual assault a major part of her platform from almost day one. This allows them to sort of, to call out Republicans for hypocrisy. Whereas, and by the way, like, Franken's a safe seat. That wasn't a super risky thing. Like, if it were in a different kind of a district, it might have been a different conversation. So they sort of sacrificed him personally for the good of the party. And in his resignation speech, he sounded so bitter and angry. And I found his resignation speech actually curdled me on him. Before that, I was kind of like, and then I just was so turned off by that speech.
Yeah. And I think, too, the way that he was treated reads differently this morning now that we know the Alabama results.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there was a lot of really impassioned and really, I think, profound soul searching last week. I mean, Dahlia Lithwick from Slate, wrote a piece, was on several podcasts and radio shows talking about her feelings about this of, like, it's great to say when they go low, we go high. And I think, I don't know, that seems really hard to argue with that as a position. But when it was the prospect of the Democrats pushing out Al Franken, a supporter of women, but with a, you know, a terrible personal sin, I guess I'll just call it that. And then the Republicans potentially welcoming Roy Moore. And so that felt just like we can't go on with this asymmetric, not warfare, but with this asymmetric set of values. But then the fact that Roy Moore was rejected, however narrowly, does make me feel much, much more positive, which I already felt positive, but now I feel much. Like
I feel reassured,
like it wasn't a terrible mistake, because I didn't think that morally it was a mistake, but I was worried that tactically it was a mistake. Because, yes, it's fine to say that, like, Franken, you know, will be replaced by a Democrat. But Franken was a really powerful Democrat. He was a very vocal and a very effective ally for women. And it's not just a vote. You also want a voice. You also want somebody who people know, who people listen to. And it takes a while often for senators to make an impression. So, you know, it wasn't just like, oh, we're just going to swap out a Democrat.
Right.
And so I was worried that I had trepidation about the Democrats going high when the Republicans were going low. Mm-hmm. And now that the Republicans don't seem to be going quite so low, or not being allowed to go low in quite as badly, of like that image of getting rid of Franken and welcoming Moore, I don't feel so bad about the U.S. Senate, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Do you think, so can we talk about the political calculus for a minute? Because I am thinking a lot about this. I mean, if you read the exchange between Trump and Kirsten Gillibrand, he essentially tweeted some insane stuff about her. You know, she's a flunky. She came to my office begging for money and said she would do anything for that money. And then he claimed there was no sexual innuendo to that. I mean, just like the usual
lightweight
insult. Oh, the light. gateway right, June, the like usual, like the completely classic, like stereotypical insulting female bullshit, right?
Especially from a big heavyweight like him. Oh.
Such yeah, it's like heavyweight. A lightweight. He's the president, right? So then she tweets back, like she's tweeting back, as is Mazie Hirono, who's the senator from Hawaii, in language which is like really taken from language of like sort of college feminism and call out culture and yep. a kind of activist feminist. Used to be subculture, is now pretty mainstream. Mm-hmm. And I found that really interesting, like just the language she used. Like, he's silencing my voice. And then Mazie Hirono saying, like, he's a misogynist. Like, it was very, like, powerful the way they tweeted back. I mean, it is a little Dahlia Lithwick in that, like, they're not taking, like, I'm a senator. I'm just going to ignore this nonsense. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. They're punching back. And it's interesting. And I couldn't tell if it, like, is it strategic? Like, we're just going to ride this really hard. And if it's strategic, is it a good idea?
Well, also, Elizabeth Warren mm-hmm. tweeted that Trump was slut-shaming Kirsten Gillibrand, which is just a crazy moment in, yeah. like, everything. I just, like, I can't picture Elizabeth Warren, like, you know, like at Slut Walk or whatever. Also, I'm not sure she exactly used it right. But yeah, so that's, like, she's clearly also borrowing the language of sort of college feminism, mm-hmm. as you put it, or a younger kind of feminism. Is it strategic or will it be effective? Which question was it?
I guess I'm asking, does it, like, are they reading this correctly? Like, I feel, you know, the complete, like, exhilaration of this moment and the feeling that this is unbelievably powerful. And it has a kind of civil rights feel, like there are just this, like, power toppling down in a way that feels completely exhilarating. And it feels like you should just ride the wave. I don't know. I mean, I'm just asking a tactical question. Like, are they reading the moment right? Is it a good idea? We can't know. I guess there's no answer to this question.
I think they're reading the moment right. How mm-hmm. long the moment will last is up for debate, but I bet the moment will last at least through 2018.
I mean, the question is, okay, maybe it's a little bit early to be thinking about 2020, but who is the candidate? I mean, I do think we need a person of color at the top of the ticket. But it can't just be a person of color. I mean, it has to be somebody who connects with people. But I mean, like a Sherrod Brown or a Tim Kaine, I don't think can generate that kind of enthusiasm. And I think maybe an Al Franken couldn't. So I do think that maybe the path to power is by not just kind of saying, oh, thanks, black people, for voting for Doug Jones, but like voting for black people.
Yeah.
Yeah. It does feel like there's a huge energy and momentum, and it would be a total mistake and a waste not to take advantage of it. That's one way to look at it. Like, there will be momentum, just sheer opposition to Trump, but it just feels like you could have this multiplier effect if you found the right person who could, in some authentic way, yes. tap into the moment.
I think actually, like, having a female candidate is going to be more symbolically important than necessarily having, if you're just, like, you know, in some smoky back room and thinking this out, yeah. I think, you know, having a female candidate is going to get you farther than necessarily going for a minority candidate. I think just, like, so much of the energy that we're talking about is driven by women and, you know, women, black women will vote for white women. Just like historically, and that's a lot of who you need on your side.
Hmm. So anyone but a man. It doesn't matter if it's a black woman, a white woman. It's just like anyone but a man.
Yeah, we're renaming our show that.
Anyone but a man.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right. Our next topic, Slack. There's been a few articles written recently about Slack as a gender-neutral zone, where it doesn't exactly wipe out gender dynamics, but it allows women to speak up in a way that they're more comfortable doing outside of a live meeting, that it tamps down some of the gender dynamics that quiet women in the real world. So I have to tell you guys, I'm a little bit of an anthropologist on Mars here. I don't use Slack that much, but I do have a lot of thoughts and have read a lot of sociological research about men and women in the written language and how they use written language. So I'm dubious about this argument. But let's just start by talking a little bit about the company Slack and its aims. Like, one of the interesting things is that this is explicit in Slack, the company. They are very interested in diversity and in promoting a more neutral kind of platform, right?
It sounds like it. So when the founder, Stuart Butterfield, won a big award, instead of going up to accept it himself, he sent up four black women who worked for the company.
And who were executives at the company, right?
Yeah, they were. Well, I don't know exactly what their position, but they were in positions of power, and they he didn't just sort of send them up there as tokens.
Right, right, right.
Although in some ways he did, right? A complicated thing. But it seems like genuinely has made an effort to hire and promote women and people of color at the company.
So that's the company Slack. Now I realize maybe we should back up even more and explain what Slack is in case people don't use Slack. So June, you want to do that? What is Slack and how do you use it?
Slack is effectively kind of the modern version of Instant Messenger in that it is a more kind of, I don't know.
It's an instant messaging service, but it's very searchable. There are a lot of chat rooms.
You can start channels for topics. You can also speak directly to people or, you know, DM. And you can sort of set up groups easily so that
you can tag people in your conversations. Right. You can upload stuff. You know, you can add GIFs to punctuate whatever it is you're saying.
But it's more in the workplace. Like what you guys are describing could be, you know, Twitter, could be lots of different things. But the point is, it's genius, inside work.
Yeah, that's the genius of Slack, is that it's taken the sort of fun of, you know, online social communication and brought it to a work environment.
Although, I mean, I think that people tend to use the paid for version at work, and I think it has taken over a lot of offices. But there's a freely available version of Slack that people can use for like social or, you know, interest group uses too. And so I actually am on a whole bunch of Slacks about really silly interests of mine. So like you actually can use it in a workplace, and then there's a kind of less powerful, because usually people use the free version for their hobbies.
So have either of you noticed a difference in gender dynamics as described in some of these articles, like a difference in the way that women interact and communicate on Slack, either with each other or with men?
Well, so first we should say that we read a couple of articles that had conflicting opinions on what Slack is doing. One woman argued that Slack is making it easier for women to be direct, right? That like, if you're not in a meeting, you're less self-conscious, you don't sort of soft pedal things, and you can just be like, can you please get me that by 3 p.m.? I have actually anecdotally noticed that I noticed it in myself that it's just easier for whatever reason when you're not in front of someone to be polite but direct. And then there was also
So can you give me an example? I'm really sorry. Can you give me an example of like what is easier for you to do on Slack? Just a kind of sentence or a kind of thing that you would find it, you know, very easy to do on Slack that would be a little harder in real life.
You know, like, I don't think that's a very good idea. I might not say that quite like that, but to sort of disagree, I think can feel easier to just, you know, the other thing that this author, the point that she made was that because communication happens so quickly on Slack, it's different than email. People want an instant response, and you don't. So with an email, let's say if you're asking someone to turn something in by X time, you might do some wind up. You might warm them up first. You might be like, it would be so helpful if you could get this in at 3. On Slack, because you're going back and forth, you're like, 3 p.m. okay? You know, just like very clear to the point.
Right. To me, that's the great advantage of it, is that one tends to use it with more brevity. And so that kind of compliment sandwich that you often do in an email, where like, I'm going to say something nice to you, then I'm going to, you know, stick the dagger in, which is a great exaggeration, and then say something nice at the end, which, you know, may be polite, may be, you know, a pleasant thing to do, but it's kind of a waste of time. And that kind of like folderol around just saying what you really want to say tends to happen less in Slack, I think.
Although I think some interactions I hate when they happen on Slack. So I'm an editor and I hate when people pitch me stories on Slack because I don't want to give an instant answer. I don't want to give a quick answer. I want to give a thought through answer. And I imagine that's the same in other industries too, where there are some things like quick in the moment things that you want to do quickly, but you might want more time to think. And so in that way, I don't love that, but that's more of a management thing than a gender thing. But so this other woman who works for Quartz, which is a news site, argued the total opposite. She argued that, in fact, Slack is exacerbating some of the male-female dynamics that have existed on the internet for a long time, that like women do still feel the need to soften and men have become even more sort of like just almost cruel in their directness on Slack. What did you guys think of that article?
I mean, that's what I was just happened to be reading a lot of early research on instant messaging, gender dynamics research, which basically mimics what Deborah Tannen, her close studies about spoken word, which is that in written word, there are just certain ticks and hesitations and hedges that women make in the early days of instant messenger. So women would use I a lot, which would seem to you like narcissistic uber move, but it's not. It's a move of subjectivity and minimizing. And women tend to use a lot of, you know, I think, or what if, or, you know, words like that, which are essentially hedge words. And men wouldn't use those words at all. Like they would make declarative, I shouldn't say at all, but much less frequently. So they would make declarative statements. So the gender dynamics in life kind of mimic themselves in the message dynamics. The difference is, listening to you guys talk, is that work requires a kind of brisk efficiency. It's not just about chatting about a topic or sharing your opinion. Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's just about getting stuff done. So maybe just the need for efficiency allows women to slot into a certain mode.
Yeah. I mean, the chat room that she was describing was a more like, let's kick around ideas kind
of
chat.
It was almost
room.
Philosophical.
Right. And there, the old patterns seem to be replicating themselves in a more sort of task-oriented channel. Maybe that would have been different.
Yeah. The other thing is that I know here, and my problem with Slack is like, I fear getting sucked in. So I'm on a lot of Slack channels, but I don't check them that often. There do seem to be like a nice flowering of subcultures. Like if you want to have a side conversation, you know, women of whatever, you can do that too. Like, is that a helpful thing? Or do you guys feel like that just creates a lot of division and distraction?
I think it can be both.
Right.
At least in my workplace, there have been sort of dust ups over secret groups that were created to basically talk about other women, frankly. And then there have been, you know, I think like I personally think it's been great for sort of fellow feeling with my colleagues and for kicking around ideas and like the weird side group. Like I'm in a weird side group where we just talk about like the columns of Ross Douthat and like and then but we end up having all totally other conversations, you know, and ideas emerge from that. But in particular, I think a lot of places have women's groups specifically where women can sort of air, you know, like talk about stuff that they might not feel comfortable talking about on the public channel for whatever reason, whether it's sort of like just super gender specific or they are able to let out anger in a certain way in a women's group or whatever.
I mean, I have a friend who remedied gender inequities at her magazine by creating a Slack group and asking women to share their salaries. And then she sort of figured out that all the women were getting paid a lot less than all the men. And so that seemed to me like a nice, powerful example of how you can use a Slack.
Although
a tool.
That doesn't actually seem like something that could only have happened on Slack. I mean, she was basically asking for a piece of information. Do you think they wouldn't have given it in any other forum?
I would find it easier to tell someone my salary not face-to-face.
Right. And it does seem like Slack has in many ways, you know, reduced our hideous email load. So I suppose,
yeah,
you know. And it just also feels a little bit more fleeting.
But I think it does sort of empower people who are not in positions of managerial prominence to sort of band together and talk about things. And that's a great example, Hannah. I'm pro-Slack. Yeah.
Yeah, I love it too. And I choose not to take part in, you know, I understand what you're saying about distraction Hannah, but when they're the groups that are optional, you know, that are not core to your work purpose, I mean, it's very easy to opt in or opt out. I really don't take part in many, you know, in things like discussions of music or food or things like that. Not because I hate those things, just because, like, that feels like a distraction to me. But, you know, but other topics I love and am probably a little bit too yucky in them. One thing I will say is that there's one place where I have seen what we might call typical gender dynamics play out. And that's when so one thing that happens with Slack is that, like, you get to know personalities and people, like, slip into certain jokes or certain, you know, ways of you know, expressing themselves, kind of callbacks, which require you to understand that person and know that person. And so I do think it's hard for new people to kind of adjust to Slack culture in a way that it's not necessarily to adjust to, like, email culture. Email culture tends to be pretty consistent. But Slack culture, I think, has more of a learning curve and a more of an adjustment to personalities. And I think when new women come into a Slack group, I think it, or in a Slack environment, that I think it's easy for them to perceive jokes and so on in a gendered way, because that is, you know, the lens by which we often see the world. So I have seen kind of that causing a problem, because there's a vibe and a kind of a we know each other kind of thing that can be hard to read when you're coming in from the outside.
On the other hand, it can make it easier to get a grasp on the social dynamics of the office. It's literally all laid out for you, and you can sort of figure out, okay, these people think the same way. These people are friends. This is how people talk in this office. And it can otherwise take a long time to figure all that out.
Yeah, that's true.
The thing I really like about Slack, but haven't been, even though I don't do it that often, is, like, workplaces used to be more chatty. I'm sure, June, you remember this. Like, when I first started and, you know, I was working at the New Republic, like, we talked a hell of a lot to each other. And then you walk into a workplace and it's like, so, you know, people don't really talk to each other that much because they're sitting at their computers. So I feel like Slack has revived a kind of office camaraderie in a really nice way.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I definitely agree with that. And I think, too, is more, I mean, I don't know if it's typical, but as more people work remotely, or, you know, companies have people in different offices, like, there are people who in our DC office who, until quite recently, because of, you know, some changes in my work, like, I talk to them all the time. And so if you report to someone who's in a different city, or you work closely with somebody in a different city, really now it doesn't feel that way. You don't see their face, maybe, but you can really have this very kind of close communication in a way that really wasn't possible before, especially if, like me, you hit the telephone.
Well, and flexible workplaces benefit women, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Listeners, if you have any interesting Slack experiences or Slack thoughts and insights about how Slack is used in your workplace and whether the gender dynamics of life are replicated in Slack or show up in some sort of slightly different but interesting way, please let us know. You can email us at xxgabfest@slate.com, or go onto our Facebook page, xxgabfest, and let us know your thoughts.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Let's go on to our next topic. A story in the latest New Yorker by Kristen Rupenian called Cat Person is about a date gone wrong. It involves a woman named Margot who's in college and a man named Robert who meets her at her job at the movie theater. They text for a while, then they go on a date, and it just doesn't go well. And for whatever reason, which we will discuss today, people have really attached to this story as encapsulating the dating dynamics of this moment. It's been the number one read story in The New Yorker for the entire time that it's been up. And I will say that everybody in that way that I know has been talking about it. Like, I've gotten emails about it. All my friends are talking about it. Do you guys have that experience as well? Noreen, do you have the experience of people in your office just hotly debating the meaning of cat person.
Yeah, our office holiday party was a couple nights ago, and I was in like five different conversations about it, and one of which we all went around and said what made us most sad.
Oh my goodness.
Cat person. So, yes.
Wow.
Topic of much discussion.
Big slack.
So, listeners, if you haven't read it yet, maybe you want to pause and go read it. It's a short story length story, so it won't take you forever. But it is you can read it online or you can read it on the New Yorker and then join us for the discussion or just listen to our discussion. Noreen, did you feel like I'm highlighting Noreen because she's dating June, not because I'm leaving you out.
I understand.
So, Noreen, when people talk to you about it, what was your sense of why? What resonated with people? Did people feel like it actually captured something about texting while dating, something about sex while dating? Like, what was it that so spoke to people?
Yeah, I mean, I think different people responded to different things, but certainly the freshness of this came from the role of technology, right? The way that the way you date now, so often you know someone more over text than you do in person. And certainly in the early days of a relationship, you're sort of filling in the pieces with your imagination and like waiting for the text to come and analyzing them. And that can be exciting and it can be kind of horrible. And and the way that like your thinking shifts throughout, I think a lot of people responded to that. And then the sex scene, I think, was done really smartly, where she sort of talks about, you know, this is essentially from the point of view of the woman, but you see, you are able to empathize with the man. But a lot of people talked to me about the sex scene, and it's sort of like porn inflected, like mm-hmm. the man is clearly, you know, imagining himself in some scenario that he's in some ways, you know, constructed probably by watching porn. And the woman gets off as imagining herself as the beautiful woman that the man must see. And so that was sort of like, okay, the way that media plays into already, you know, the complicated dynamics of what turns people on. And then the post breakup sort of denouement, mm-hmm. which I hated the very end of the story. I thought it was very pat and took it in a direction that, like, in some ways undermined the subtlety of the rest of it. But the sort of way that after you've broken up with someone that you in like a very short term relationship that you don't know what went wrong. Mm-hmm. And she captures that really well. And then like the temptation of having like a way to contact them, like, right. It's like right at your fingertips. And the man sort of like exercises that in a bad way. What did you guys find most striking about the story? Did it feel, you know, did it feel of this time to you or sort of timeless with sort of modern updates?
I will say what I found the saddest, which is maybe timeless, but the extreme not knowing each other while knowing each other.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I know that's a phenomenon. And I know there's a projection involved in all kinds of dating. There was a projection and there was a version of projection involved in the 1940s when when you would know someone just by their symbols, you know, just sort of what they looked like or what little things they said in letters or you saw them. So there's always, you know, and then you would doodle like, you know, how you would get married to. It's like projection is part of dating. But I think the trick in this, the deceptive nature of projection just hit me so hard, the way you fantasize an entire world around mm-hmm. a person. And it seems like, you know, some of the fantasy takes place while she's at her parents' house. And so she's kind of, I don't know, there was just something like really moving about that she's texting with him and her parents are asking her, who are you texting with so much? And that kind of solidifies his status as her boyfriend. They haven't even gone on a date yet. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think she really well captured the complete alienation and kind of way that you can trick yourself or your consciousness can trick yourself into thinking you know a lot about this person, you're intimate with this person, when you actually know absolutely nothing about this person. My mother-in-law said something so interesting, which is she said, you know, this is like an argument for kind of marriage arrangement or something. like now you understand why people kind of why the act of setting someone up who, you know, where you know the family and you know basically what world they come from is helpful, because those are real things, you know. I mean, this person, the man especially, is portrayed like you have no idea about him. You know, you don't even know if he has cats.
Well, I was going to ask
his name
you
is Cat Person.
Do you think he had cats in the end? That was another topic of much office discussion. Did the cat person have cats?
I think it's a pure projection. Like he's Cat Person is another thing where like there's so much clever gender stuff going on about the story. And I completely flipped about the last line. In fact, I flipped like in the middle of the night last night when I was thinking about it, and I had a whole different view of it. But and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I think you know, how much do you project on the idea of the cat lady and like what it means to live alone with your cats? Mm-hmm. And so I think she's sort of playing with us like, well, a man at home with his cats, like, what does that mean exactly? And then he forgets that he told her that he had cats, even though they had this whole joke going with the cat. There's so much going on with the cats, even though like, they had a whole thing going with the cats, like a whole flirty thing. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't even remember kind of that they had that in the moment. So it's like everything's lost. And then the cats are named after these Japanese manga characters. And so you think a certain way about him, like he's a guy who reads manga and what goes along with that. Anyway, the alienation and kind of trickery and loneliness of thinking that you know the person and you don't was what made me the most sad.
See, it's interesting, Hannah, because, yeah, I mean, I definitely it feels like this story is about projection and about how we build up stories about people in our heads. And I did feel like the use of kind of modern technology makes it sound old, but like the way we communicate now does definitely, you know, enhance that. But I wonder, that didn't make me feel sad because when Margot is at home with, you know, on break with her parents and she's having this texting relationship with him, like she really enjoys it. She's not, yes, she's telling herself these stories and telling her parents about this guy she really likes, who's, you know, who we know she doesn't actually know, but she knows a part of him. She knows those texts. She finds those texts funny and satisfying in some way. So I don't think we should dismiss the text as kind of a, you know, a bad story that she's told herself. That's real, but it's only a part of their compatibility. Like they're very compatible by text, but in person, not so much, in part because they are much more compatible in theory than in practice. But that's still a form of compatibility. And I'm not sure, too, that he forgot about the cats, because I believe when he took her to his home, he said, oh, I have cats. Whether he did or not is different, but you know, yeah. It's like there's some of these things are lies and things that we always try to like present a part of ourselves to make someone attractive to us or to make someone attracted to us. But they're not necessarily lies exactly. It's just like putting your best foot forward.
Right. She was able to get to a place of more intimacy and closeness with him at a distance than actually after having spent time with him and slept with him. Like, actually, you don't see the content of their dates so much. You see the sort of negotiations around, like, moments when she felt embarrassed for herself or embarrassed for him.
Yeah.
And you see the negotiations around, like, you know, whether she's going to sleep with him or not. But you don't like, learn in the way that if you spent 3 hours with someone, you would learn a certain amount about them, you know.
Right.
But that, I think, is a sharp way that the writer helped you feel how lonely it can feel on a date where you're not connecting.
I want to say too, I mean, just to mention that this is a dirty story. I mean, it's essentially
true.
It's a story about bad sex, but it's still a story about sex. I mean, that I think is a good part of the reason that it's done well. I mean, I don't generally read the fiction, honestly, in the New Yorker, so I don't know how many of the stories that they publish involve sex scenes, but this is a pretty again, not particularly sexy,
not
but
sexy,
still,
yeah.
You know, like, you know, you're talking about, you know, Rumpy Pumpy and that's, you know, who doesn't want an excuse to talk about a sex scene?
Yeah. And people really, one sort of set, I think it went viral for a few different reasons. One, because it was, I think, a good story.
Yeah.
And two, because then it became a conversation about, you know, about why we're talking about Cat Person. And then all the think pieces landed. And I just saw today that The Cut interviewed six cats on video about Cat Person, which is sort of like, I hope the end of it. But the third reason is,
what did you think about the consent, like the the implications for consent? You know, she was consenting, but then she didn't want to have sex anymore, but it was too much effort. And she was kind of image managing even in the moment when she decided not to give consent. She wasn't exactly,
you mean to give consent?
She did give consent, but then she didn't want to be having sex anymore. But in that moment, she didn't stop having sex, mostly because she didn't want to be the kind of person who would stop having sex. It was not about the usual thing we talk about, which is I'm going to hurt his feelings or, you know, being kind or anything like that. There were other moments like that. But in that moment, it was about not wanting to be the kind of person who, as she put it, orders something in a restaurant and then returns it. It was about not being, she didn't want to see herself as a petulant person, which is a slightly different reason than we usually talk about in consent.
To me, that was a part of the kind of nuance of the story. I mean, it didn't seem to me that she had withdrawn her consent. It was just the fact that she was able to reveal the processes that were going on while she was having sex, perhaps because the sex wasn't all that good, that she knows that, okay, if this had started a few minutes later, maybe it wouldn't have started. But I don't think she ever, it doesn't seem like she really, like, she doesn't truly want to stop because it feels like she could. But I think it's just a kind of a very telling way about how, you know, how nuanced, the nuanced ways that people think about what's going on while it's going on. But it didn't seem like she was having, you know, that she was withdrawing consent at any point.
Yeah, I didn't read this as a story about consent because actually, like, a few things happened that I think were just made it so clear. Like, they go back to his apartment, and instead of sort of like fooling around and then it progressing, they like both take off their clothes. Like, it's like sort of just like, okay, we're doing this. And to me, the smartness about it, and I think part of the reason why it did connect with so many people and go viral, is that it like was about what a lot of people have experienced, which is like bad but consenting sex. And that's what you're not sort of allowed to complain about. And that's sort of one school of thought, is that like, because we don't allow people to discuss the like the isolation or badness of this kind of encounter, then they might criminalize or like say, oh, I did, you know, that's one theory that people, you know, tend to. Anyway, I don't want to poke.
You mean that she would look back at this and think of this as a non-consensual encounter or a form of assault? Her emotional alignment was that she did not want to be having sex, but in fact she didn't object in the moment.
Well, not exactly this kind of an encounter, but something similar to that. I think some people have made that argument. That's a sort of a separate conversation. I think what a lot of people were doing with this story was measuring their own experiences next to it, and the word relatable was thrown around a lot. Like, I found this relatable. I didn't find this relatable. Like, I had super interesting conversations with men who were like, I recognized myself in that. Maybe not my current self, but like, you know, the person I was before I met my girlfriend or like whatever. And there was empathy on, like, it's weird the way that she, weird and smart, I think, the way that she tells it all through the woman's eyes, but you do get this sense of sympathy for the man at certain points, even when the woman isn't necessarily feeling that way.
Mm-hmm.
Until the end, of course.
Until the end. So let's talk about the end. Noreen, you seem to have strong feelings, which I used to share until the middle of the night last night. But why don't you say your strong feelings and then...
Well, so at the end of the story, she runs into... She sees him. She's their friends at a college bar. Her friend had actually sent him quite a cruel breakup text, like, you know, basically, I don't want to see you anymore. And he's drinking alone at the college bar, which is sort of a figure of pathetic loneliness, is just alone surrounded. He's a 34-year-old man surrounded by college kids. And she sort of runs out when she sees him.
Surrounded by her friends.
Surrounded by her
hiding
friends.
Hiding her.
Including a guy. And he sends her a text afterwards and is essentially like, it was nice to see you. You looked pretty. And then it sort of devolves, right? Like, levels of devolvement. Like, so then he says, you know, that guy that you were with, are you dating him? Like, there's a moment in when they had sex where he's like, have you ever done this before? Because she's a 20-year-old college student and she seems to have recoiled at something he's done. And then in the text exchange, she's like, he's like, oh, were you so horrified because you like fuck so many guys or something? Are you fucking that guy? Are you fucking him right now? And then the thing ends with, the story ends with him just saying whore. And so he's gone from being sad and lonely that she, you know, had, and wondering what had gone wrong, to just like projecting onto her You know, in the beginning of the story, it's a projection of happiness, relationship, connection, and then it's a projection of anger and assuming that she is, you know, this bad thing. And I just, it felt like all the complexity and subtlety and back and forth of the previous whole story were boiled down into this sort of like think piece punchline, like men are bad and they, you know, they like hate you if you don't have sex and they hate you if you do have sex and they just hate you. And you could see something curdling that way, but it just, it like, it felt like a, like, you know, I want them to hear me all the way in the cheap seats kind of thing.
Hmm. You know, that's what I thought. And it really, like, it really, it kind of rattled me, that last line, when I read the story, because I kind of projected it onto our whole culture. I was like, oh no, this is the black and white world we live in. Yeah. Like, we can sustain a kind of grayness and empathy and kind of a vision into each other's souls for about half an hour. And then we will always punctuate and land with whore. And that's where we'll end it. And then I went through a phase of thinking, well, no, this is just revenge. Like, you know, in the old, in the sort of John Cheever and even Norman Mailer stories, because they were written by men and the men were controlling the pen, they were the authors, you would have a certain sympathy for women, like you were. They're you know, amazing writers, and they would draw the portrait of women kind of in a way that you could understand and relate to. But ultimately, it's a man's perspective. Like, ultimately, the man's view wins. So then I thought, oh, maybe that's what that last line is about, like sort of giving the final view back to a woman author and turning the tables that way, because the woman is in college, whereas it seems like the man is a loser. Like, she may have lost in the sexual encounter, but it seems like in the big, broader world, like, she's the more successful human. She's surrounded by friends. She's in college. Like, it just seems like, you know, she owns
well, that's,
the narrative in a way.
That's interesting. I mean, that's also like a projection of hers, that, you know, that someone who lives alone and goes to the movies alone is a loser. And
yeah.
I don't know that that's, you know, you don't know a ton about him and like what his friendship. I mean, you do see that image of him at the college bar alone, which is a sad moment.
And trying to impress her with college stuff. But the last thing I want to say is, like, then I realized, well, isn't this just saying that horror is as much kind of false and a projection as everything else? Like, it's just a moment, just like everything that happened between them and sex is just a moment and everything keeps shifting and sliding. Horror, why would horror be more definitive than any other thing in the story? Just because it's the last line.
Yeah, it just felt like was like he'd, yeah, I suppose I could argue myself into that like, you know, you're back to the depersonalization and all of a sudden she's not a real person in front of him. He's essentially like behaving like an anonymous troll on the internet and just like calling her a whore. Like, it does feel like it's sunk back into a textual relationship. And instead of being the witty, this is my best self one, it's like, here's what I really think of you.
But the textual relationship was false. Like, that's the point of the story. So then this text would be no more real or false, no less fleeting than any other text that passed between them. It was just a moment. He was probably drunk and pissed off that he had been left out.
Mm-hmm.
And so he called her a whore. And then the next morning he would forget about it. All right. Well, listeners, if you relate it to anything particularly in Cat Person, and especially if you have views about the last line, we really want to hear them. So email us, xxgapfest@slate.com, or go onto our Facebook page and tell us what you think. All right. Let's do our recommendations. June, you first.
Before I get to my recommendation, I just want to put in a plug for another Slate podcast, Working. It's a long-running series about jobs and how people spend their working lives and what they think about what they do and why. And the current host is Jacob Brogan. He's been doing it for a couple of years now. And right now, we're in the middle of a really interesting season, which is about LGBTQ jobs. Jacob has spoken with a drag queen, Ms. Cracker, who has been a guest on the XX Gabfest, and that was an amazing episode. He's also spoken with a queer theorist, a bespoke tailor, a gender reassignment surgeon, and next week, the guest is Samuel R. Delaney, the amazing sci-fi writer and writer generally. So please tune in to Working. You'll find a new episode every Sunday. So, like I think most people I know, I have been watching The Crown since it became available last Friday, December 8th. And It's a soap opera, but it's a soap opera with a few like vague historical tones and historical storylines. And Vanessa Kirby is so fantastic as Princess Margaret. I think we all want to be Princess Margaret while many of us know that we're really Elizabeths. And Claire Foy is so fantastic as Elizabeth. I just, as with most shows, I could like, I just pretend that the men aren't there. But the women of the show are so fantastic. And I just, I'm not going to claim it's the greatest show ever, but it's really, really watchable. And I'm just loving it.
Cool.
I'm not saying anything.
You hate it?
I really do hate it. But oh, David likes it. It's a split in our household about whether it's delightfully watchable or kind of soap operatically unwatchable.
Nothing wrong with soap operas.
That's true. All right. Well, I am going to recommend the Jonathan Goldstein podcast Heavyweight, which is a new Gimlet podcast. It's not new Gimlet podcast. I just have been binge listening to Heavyweight, which I think is so great. It's kind of a genius little construction of a podcast where he goes out and solves people's problems. And so you come to him with a problem that you've had for a long time, like in one case, why was I kicked out of my sorority? In another case, you know, who was that guy who hit me on a car and kind of ruined my life and sent me on a new trajectory? And so he helps you hunt down and find those people. And he's just hilarious and charming, as he always has been on the radio. But I just think that Heavyweight is like a perfect little gem of a universe he's created with so much stakes and momentum. And it's so funny. And I just love it. Noreen.
First, this is not my real endorsement, but I just want to say that I've watched a few episodes or a couple episodes of American Vandal, and 3 out of 3 of your feminist podcasters agree that this show about dicks is really funny.
Yes. Yes.
And then my real endorsement is Tina Brown's The Vanity Fair Diaries, which was just super fun to read. So it's a written, she was in her early 30s, or 30, 29, 30, when she took over Vanity Fair. She'd come over from England, and she kept, well, she allegedly kept this diary that was super detailed. I suspect that she, you know, scribbled some things down and really went back and constructed a narrative over it now when she went back and did it. But it's full of 80s gossip. And if you're a magazine dork like me, like sort of how she thought about putting together Vanity Fair, what it was like to be a woman in that big of a job. And it's just like really fun, you know. So whatever the winter equivalent of a beach read is, it's a fireside read.
That's great. All right. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you, as always, to our wonderful producer, Verilyn Williams, and our production assistant, Daniel Schrader. Listeners, please go onto our Facebook page. We love hearing from you. We love hearing your comments, your suggestions. We love it when you argue with each other and when you argue with us. It's facebook.com/XXGabFest. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will be back in 2 weeks.